jasoncharles.net.
Deep talk, deep sounds.
I've got so much work to do.
This is Pieces of Work on jasoncharles.net.
So my name's Christopher Thomas Allen. I'm an artist based in London, and my work crosses a range of different disciplines, from moving image and documentary, interactive projects, installations, film, live performance, design, animation. And I collaborate a lot. I work with a lot of different people from different backgrounds and have for a long time been influenced by and created work that combines these different things with music and performance and storytelling, I suppose. So yeah, my roles are many. I wear different hats. Sometimes I'm filming and editing. Sometimes I'm interviewing people. Sometimes I'm sort of producing and directing and writing applications and trying to get funding. So I think, like a lot of people who work in this day and age, you know, the disciplines are quite blurry, you know, and that's led to some really interesting work and some beautiful collaborations. You know, I wasn't trained as an artist, you know, I was not come from an art background in that sense. My background is actually more as a designer. So I sort of look for problems. I try to communicate things, you know, I try to make work that expresses or communicates something. So I grew up in London. My dad was a photographer. He sort of worked on lots of different things, but mainly kind of product photography and interiors and stuff like that. So I was sort of around images and photography from a very young age. My grandfather on my mother's side had been a bit of a kind of an early adopter of technology and had apparently built his own TV set and things. And sadly, I never knew him because he died before I was born. But my mom had sort of carried on utilizing his 8mm camera. And so from a very, very young age, we would project these cine films at home onto a screen. And that had really captivated me. This idea of the projection and the light and the kind of the memory of these holidays and these sort of windows into the past that gave, and the way that the projector could be kind of pointed at anything, you know, that the image didn't need to be on a screen, it could be on the curtains or so. That really influenced me. And then my other great influence really was my brother Ben, who was a DJ and a music producer. And from a very young age, he was really influenced by jazz music. My dad was a very kind of big jazz freak and was in the sort of Ronnie Scott's and places like that in London in the sort of 50s and 60s. So there was a bit of a record collection in my house, and Ben became really into, like, in the 80s and early 90s, like hip hop and American sort of urban music, I'd say, and sample based music. And so he would go to these car boot sales. I don't know if it's a thing where the listener is, but in the UK we have the car boot sale, which is like people rock up and sell a load of junk out of the back of their car on a Sunday. Ben would go hunting and go crate digging to find like things and samples, and rather than try to chase him around and, you know, find the record before he did or whatever, I just started buying up old equipment. You know, there was a lot of obsolete equipment. It was the sort of beginning of the 90s when I was studying. I'd done art and then I started doing design, and I got a place at university at an art college doing a thing called media design. So I started doing the projection thing off the back of just going to these car boot sales, collecting old cine equipment, playing around with some of the stuff at home. My dad would bring home all these old kind of transparencies that he was getting processed, because his photography was pre-digital, so he was working with transparency film. And so I would like cut up the transparencies, these little Lee lighting filters you get for lighting filtered, like the little swatches, and they kind of fit perfectly over a 35mm slide. And so I just make up my own slides, and I kind of bought some old carousel slide projectors from a hospital in London that was getting rid of them. So there was a whole load of this sort of analog stuff that was getting ditched at the beginning of the 90s because the video was coming in and digital stuff. And so it was really just out of this sort of real fascination, really, and love for kind of the old obsolete equipment, the old analog equipment that my studio sort of started, really. We would make these sort of collages, multiple projectors producing sort of collages of static kind of graphic slide imagery. Started off working with Super 8 loops, 8mm loops, and then I met a guy called Andy Flywheel in a little camera shop in Camden, which is called Lee's Cameras. And it was like the only place in London where you could buy the rubber bands that drove the projector arms. And they would charge so much for these things. And most of the time when you go into those shops, it was full of like these slightly old people who were just enthusiasts. And I walked in there one day and there was this guy in a sort of tracksuit who looked kind of cool. And I was like, well, what are you doing in here? And he was like, oh, I'm just buying rubber bands. And so we sort of bonded, and he was doing some stuff in Southwest London. And so we started working together, and we started the Light Surgeons in London. The name, the Light Surgeons, I sort of struggle with it actually over the years, because it sort of had a real kind of resonance at the beginning, because it seemed to describe what we were sort of doing. We were this weird group of people kind of splicing film and making these sort of light shows. So it sort of had that connotation. But as the work became less about that and became more audiovisual, in some ways it sort of confused, you know. I've had so many people over the years go, oh, well, you do lighting, don't you? And it's like, no, we don't do lighting. So in some ways it sort of misrepresented us. But the actual origin of that was actually from the very first person I worked with while I was studying, was a guy called Paul O'Connor. And his father used to tell him this story when he was a kid about these people called the Light Surgeons who would heal you while you were sleeping. And they were these kind of benevolent spiritual entities that would come and heal you, you know? And I think for me, that was what I was really interested by. I was like, this idea that art and film and culture heals us, you know, it acts as a balm. It allows us to reflect on who we are in a sort of therapeutic way, and sort of, you know, define the world around us and hopefully change it and define it. So there's quite a sort of philosophical kind of idea behind the idea of the Surgeons of Light to me. So a little bit after spending time doing these sort of installations more than visuals in clubs, they were like these sort of multi-screen, sort of multi-projected analog dioramas that would cover space, and we would use gauze and netting. So they had a very sort of three-dimensional quality to them. And then sort of adapting that to a concert stage and touring with bands and stuff, that's a sort of different design process. You know, the show has to go on a stage and be set up quickly, and then you've got to work with set pieces of music. You know, when you're in a club and someone's DJing, you don't know what the next piece of music's going to be. You might know the genre, but you don't know what they're going to play next. So there's a certain level of improvisation. So when you move into doing concert shows, there's something quite exciting about being able to deal with this sort of theatricality of a show and each track. And it allows for, you know, dialogue and collaboration with the artists and conversations. And sometimes there's a lot of that. You know, we worked with this band Corner Shop, who were some friends of mine. One of my first jobs and only jobs I ever had was working at a record label called Beggar's Banquet. They're like one of the bigger independent labels in the UK that has like 4AD, Young Turk, and XL Records was part of it as well. So I was working in their art department, and there was a guy there, Ben, who was used to do all the production for like the record releases, and he was one part of Corner Shop. And so we worked a lot with Corner Shop, and that was probably one of the first big tours we did, was with them in America. We were like supporting Oasis, doing these big stadium shows, setting up a video screen, running all our visuals off like laser discs, which were like these massive lot of floppy discs things that you had to turn over. They were like insane. So, you know, we had some time with sort of bands, and we did a lot of work with different bands on the Ninja Tune label, particularly Herbalizer. We did a lot of touring with Cinematic Orchestra, is another band that we worked with a bit, and did some of their first shows. And then we did a big show in the Sydney Opera House in Australia with them. Propeller Heads, we did some Sneaker Pimps shows in America that was all analog, that was like touring with 16mm film. But it varied really in terms of the involvement with the band. Sometimes, you know, there was a lot of that and the band were really into it. Like the Sneaker Pimps had a lot of references and filmic references that they loved, and we either took sort of directly sampled things or made things that evoked that. And then sometimes, you know, you have these slightly awkward sort of layered and slightly disparate kind of relationships where there's a lot of management involved, the band didn't maybe really want to kind of like engage so much with the work. And it sort of morphed into the people that really have the power in that world are the lighting designers. And when you get into the bigger kind of shows and the bigger productions and the kind of U2s and the kind of things like that, you know, we made content, I would say, although I hate that expression, we made video content for them. But, you know, we never talked to them. You know, there was never any real, it was just through the lighting people. There was just such a sort of tiered sort of layer cake of people involved when it gets to that level. I never really enjoyed that aspect. So, that, I mean, that's why I gravitated more towards audiovisual, live cinema sort of style projects that we started to develop ourselves, because they were kind of being created by us, you know, like Jude Greenaway, who was an artist who I met and studied with when I was about 18. And we won a young person's film co-op award together, making our first like abstract 16mm film. And he came back from France and worked with me for a long time and was part of the studio. And then he started making his own music. And so he was one of the first people to really develop the sound under the name The Light Surgeons. And he's now very prolific and has several record labels and puts music out and does amazing visual stuff as well. But yeah, I think that that sort of process of working with people who are not just, you know, working on visuals, but we're also thinking about sound, we're thinking about music. Tim Cowie is the other artist that I suppose I've worked the most with in the last sort of 15 years. And he joined the studio in about 2005, I think, and came in when I'd literally just been asked to make a really exciting work by a woman called Kathleen Ford, actually, who was at the time working for a place called MPAC, which is up in Troy near Rensselaer Polytechnic in upstate New York. And she was part of this MPAC place that was about to open, and she commissioned our first sort of live cinema project called True Fictions, which was a sort of piece exploring myth and truth in the state of New York. So it was a sort of conversation or a dialogue between New Yorkers and Native American New Yorkers around this idea of truth and myth. And Tim worked on that a lot in the post-production. I recorded all these different musicians in Brooklyn under the Brooklyn Bridge Dumbo with my brother Ben, who was based in New York at the time. And that became the music and the score to this live show that we did called True Fictions. And that's one of the first things Tim worked on. And then Tim and me have continued to work together and recently released an album of music from our project that we did in Malaysia together. My work's always been really collaborative. I love working with other people. I'm a natural collaborator, I suppose. And I think as someone who's not a kind of trained musician and someone who didn't go down that path, sadly, I kind of wish I had in many ways. I've always like loved the way like bands and the kind of unconscious communication that comes from people playing instruments together. I think there's something very interesting and sort of transcendent about that human practice. It's very ancient, this idea of how we form stories collectively as communities or as people. And I feel like the kind of new media and the sort of digital media, you know, can be that also, you know, and in some ways it's forced us into a very individualistic sort of way of working and thinking about ourselves. But I think it is also offers up lots of opportunities to do things in a collaborative way and to sort of form groups and to leave space for each other and to allow happenstance and chance and things like that to come in, you know. So again, it's a sort of jazz music, I suppose, was an influence on that, you know, the idea of, you know, having improvisation and exploring things, but also bringing in a story. I think that sort of led me to sort of documentary, really. I've always found, like, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. You know, I've often just found the conversations I have with people and what's going on in the real world almost so kind of compelling that the idea of sitting there and writing a fictional film or something seems sort of strange to me. But it's led to so many different collaborations for me. And I think you learn, you know, you just learn through kind of working with other people. And you also kind of unlearn, you know, the idea of sort of not being an expert is also kind of important. So there's been so many different inspirations because of the collective aspect of this. Working with other people, you would kind of learn about different things, you know, be it like the history of visual music and abstract animation and Len Lai and Norman McLaren and those types of artists who I wasn't aware of when I was starting out. But then as I started to do shows, people would come up to me and go, oh, have you seen this? Or you know, in the early days, we were like sampling videos. So we'd be like taking bits out of like classic sort of cinema films and really kind of doing what people were doing with hip hop, but doing it with film and 16mm film. But then as I kind of did more and more work and as our work sort of drifted away from the kind of club world particularly, and it became more seen as sort of art and in galleries, I learned more about people who've pioneered work in that area too. You know, media artists, video artists, Nam June Paik, Bill Viola was one of Bill Viola's show actually that he did at the Whitechapel Gallery, I think at the very beginning of the 90s, was a really big influence on me. I mean, I really wanted to be a video artist, but the sort of access to being a video artist is difficult. You know, the art world, even though the UK has an amazing reputation as this sort of place for art and culture, it's got a lot of threshold guardians, I would say, to coin a Joseph Campbell expression. And so I didn't really feel like I fitted that easily into that either. And so the club scene and the sort of liminal scene between art and kind of music and film was interesting and allowed me to explore stuff. I mean, there's countless artists, Laurie Anderson, obviously, American artists, musicians like Steve Reich was a real influence as we sort of started to sort of listen to more contemporary classical music. There's a lot of influences of that in some of our projects. Philip Glass's score for Quanah Squatsy was also really early. Yeah, I think it was a sociology student who lived downstairs from me when I was studying at Portsmouth University who lent me a video, VHS copy of Quanah Squatsy and said, oh, you got to watch this. And that totally blew my head off. Films like Quanah Squatsy, Gregory Rodriguez's films and the rest of that sort of oeuvre, these kind of amazing filmic sort of musical pieces that really just, without words, transport you into looking at human beings and our sort of place in the world. And I was sort of interested in how art can sort of transcend these things to ask sort of quite deep questions about who we are and where we're going and what the world is and means and how it could change. We are here so momentarily, fleetingly, and yet we're so inexplicably aware of who we are and our position and, you know, just the sort of intensity of all of those things. I think that kind of bubbles up in the different projects we've made. I suppose the other influences on the sort of themes would be, I guess, sort of psychogeography and Ian Sinclair, the writer, the British writer, work like Patrick Keeler's films, London and Robertson in Space. And these kind of films that are kind of poetic documentaries, really, that are sort of allow you to dream and to think and to contemplate spaces and places and identities and histories, because I felt that they're all very relatable to me. I feel like, you know, you can kind of only really make work that's reflective on who you are and where you are. And as someone who grew up in a really amazing city like London, that's so culturally diverse and vibrant and interesting, but also has huge kind of inequalities built into it and terrible housing and, you know, all these things that, you know, people in other cities face as well. We're living in a very globalized world. I suppose the sort of attraction was to try to make work that could relate to people. I think maybe it was a bit of a reaction actually to thinking back on it now and looking at the early days. It was very sort of celebratory and going out and being in clubs and being surrounded by music and the sort of escapism and abstraction of all of those things to me led me to really want to make work that was rooted in reality, that had a sort of social political aspect to it, that was critical, that engaged people in a story, you know, because for so many years I was sort of in this a beautifully free space of sort of pioneering, I guess, what you would call VJ culture or VJing. We were really involved in that and innovated that in the UK particularly. But I think, yeah, there's a sort of endlessness to that. There's a sort of endless remix. There's an endless abstraction and sort of dance that you can do with that work that is really fun. And it's you know, I still enjoy going back to doing things like that now and again. But I think from an early age, spending a long time doing it and having some success at doing it and then setting up a company doing it and then working for lots of different record labels and dealing with the kind of, you know, the egos and the sort of world of clubs and music. Yeah, it just really led me to want to sort of make work that told a bit of a story and that where it allowed me to maybe work more directly and collaborate more directly with the musicians and the music was more holistic, you know. And that's what sort of brought us to this sort of idea of audio visual performance, which is now very common. You know, you look at a flyer or a poster for a festival in 2023 and, you know, many people will say, oh, this is an AV set. That didn't exist, you know, like 15, 20 years ago, no one was talking about that. So we were kind of pioneering that, and we were pioneering it in almost sort of gonzo journalism sort of way, you know. We were going out in a sort of Merry Pranksters-esque way. We were gathering interviews with people on the street. We were filming things that we saw. We were photographing things we saw, and we were just sort of remixing them and using the sort of tools and the approach of say, hip-hop artists or our contemporaries who are making music and just sort of applying that to a range of media and performing it as a live show to kind of seated audiences, actually. I think that was the other thing that was kind of important was that sort of, you've got an audience who's standing up and dancing, then you've got a slightly different responsibility, you know, and it's a different dynamic and you're in a different space. As soon as you enter a space where people are sitting down, like a cinema or a theatre, you've got a captive audience in a different way. And there's a sort of responsibility to take those people on a journey and tell a bit of a story. And so that I really relished. I really, you know, the moment we got the opportunity to sort of move our work out of clubs or concerts and do sit down shows in theatres, that really changed the game for me. And then that led to other things like galleries and installations and work with museums and what have you. We've been lucky to kind of have a fairly good ride of being funded through commissions or projects for the last sort of 10 years. One of the last projects that we did commissioned just before the pandemic was a proposal that was brought to us by the British Film Institute. And we've done a lot of different stuff for the BFI over the years and worked on some events and done shows and toured some of our live cinema shows with them. And they had a specific commission to make a piece of work about Japan that was going to happen and coincide with the Olympics in 2020. So they had a kind of Japan season. And they, part of what the BFI do is they restore and collect films. They have a big film archive. And so they'd gone into this archive and they dug out some never seen before film restorations that were on very, very early films on Japan, very early cinema, like going back to 1896, I think was the earliest stuff. And so we were invited to make something with that material, and an amazing composer, musician, percussionist called Midori Takada, who I would say is a little bit like a sort of Japanese Steve Reich. Don't know whether she would kind of agree with that, but she's an incredible pioneer, I'd say, of sort of minimal classical ambient music in Japan. And so the plan was for us to make a live cinema show that was going to be on at the South Bank Center. And we started that process. I collected and edited all these sort of documentary archival films that were being restored and edited them into a story. I traveled out to Japan just before the pandemic started and recorded all this contemporary footage that was retracing all of this stuff and like kind of making this sort of connection between the past and the present. And then the idea was to then present it with this layer on top of it, which was to represent the sort of future. And the future kind of layer was about artificial intelligence and about how all these archives are almost like these kind of stratospheric layers of information that will, in the future, and this is happening already, will be sort of mined by these sort of semi-autonomous sort of artificial intelligences that are going to be digging through all this data, all this film, all these Instagram posts, all these photographs, all the things that you've said on social media, and it will be sort of digesting it, and it will kind of be understanding us and being, yeah, maybe in a kind of benevolent way, trying to become more like us or trying to understand what we want, but maybe in a slightly sinister way. You know, this sort of movement towards general artificial intelligence, this sort of sum total of human beings and our interconnectivity is to sort of birth this behemoth hive mind. I mean, that's the sort of sinister sci-fi, you know, situation. And whether that's a sort of conscious entity that has its own ideas, possibly, maybe it's just a kind of horribly kind of idea of a society we already live in, which is like these huge companies that siphon off all the money and information and power. And, you know, we're sort of, you know, the slaves to that. I don't know. I mean, I am fascinated by this sort of advent of artificial intelligence. It's sort of unavoidable. It's moving so fast. I mean, we made that project back in 2020. I think the actual installation that we made that was called Tokinakawa, which means a river in time, which was a sort of six screen video installation that we're hoping to show and tour and do some more things with. You know, the kind of AI that we were working with then, which was really based on a thing called, it's a sort of TensorFlow or YOLO. It's used in driverless cars. You know, it's this idea of being able to sort of identify objects and tag objects and, you know, computer vision over films. So we were using some sort of code that did that, really to reveal this sort of biases, you know, that are built into that, you know, that technology. But then also to make a point about film as well, that film has an implicit bias in it as well. You know, the orientalism of these production companies that would go to Japan to make these films back in like the early 19th century and the beginning of cinema, you know, it was the sort of, you know, that there was all these things aren't new, you know, so they're just sort of changed. They've just changed. They've just evolved. They've become, you know, bigger, more powerful, more monetized. And lots of the sort of human questions are sort of still the same, I suppose. Sort of psychological Lynchian space, which I mean, Lynch is another massive influence on my work and always has been. But like, I love that. I love that aspect to it. But I think the sort of more the implications of it as a technology, I really don't think we've grasped. And I think we're just trapped in this sort of cycle as a culture, as a society of just progression for the sake of it. So that was what we were sort of trying to explore with that piece of work. Yeah, I think there's a lot of different themes that the work kind of looks at and covers. Super Everything was this big live cinema commission that we did in Malaysia for the British Council 10 years ago when we'd been out to Malaysia and we'd done all this research and we'd gathered this kind of body of material and we were sort of sculpting this three-part sort of story that moved us through the landscape, through society, economy, the past, all these different things. It's a very ambitious project. Research has become a really big part of the work that we do. The last big project that I worked on with Tim was a collaboration with an anthropologist called Paul Basu, who is at SOAS University, and he's a professor of anthropology. So the whole project went on for about 4 years in the end, and it was it's all funded by research funding, you know, so researching things and having time to, you know, work with academics and researchers and scientists and stuff like that is really where I'd like to do more stuff. So yeah, that's been the sort of case for the last 8 to 9 years. I've sort of been, you know, working as an individual artist studio and then forming these kind of collaborations through people like Tim and different software developers and trying to find, you know, trying to keep my overheads as low as possible to sort of have the freedom really to sort of pick the work that I find interesting and not kind of be forced to do loads of the commercial stuff. You know, if things are interesting, sometimes the commercial projects are great because, you know, they happen real quick and people kind of, if they share your vision and they come to you, then sometimes they're very creative and they get, you know, you get to do something really cool quickly with money, you know, and other things, they just evolve gradually. Like some of the more recent shows we've done, myself and Tim have been performing a audio visual show called Atemporal, which is a piece of work that we made really to sort of reflect on and celebrate this guy called John Berger, who was also an influence on both of us. We both studied at Portsmouth, but about 10 years apart. And this book, Ways of Seeing, was a real kind of influence on us both. And so when he passed away about 4 years ago, we did this show as a sort of remembrance to him. And that was kind of cobbled together really out of material that I had been working on, art projects I'd been doing, bits of material that we had made for other people. Like we'd done a load of work for the BFI, who I mentioned. We did this big show with the Cinematic Orchestra that only got really shown one time. So sometimes, you know, you're making these things and they're very fleeting, you know, they're sort of there and they're gone and then they don't exist and have any. So, you know, we've got some of the live shows are kind of like a collage of of elements and things that we've created that we repurpose and weave together and create this piece that can, we can sort of say, okay, this is now a piece of work that we can perform and present. And they evolve as well as a performances. That's what's nice about them as live shows, is they're never totally static. They're always mixed slightly differently, or we'll add something or take something away and change it depending on the situation and if we have some time. Sometimes the live performance stuff is a bit like being a, I used to say it's a bit like being a dancer, because you're kind of there, you're interpreting music, or you're doing this kind of thing that sort of people are watching, and then it sort of dissipates and it's gone, and there's no record of it. It's very ephemeral, and it kind of slips through your fingers like sand, you know. And that was always kind of challenging, but then it also work begets work. So you do a show, people see the show, you have an audience, there's always, you know, you've got 200 people in the audience, you know, there's going to be maybe a couple of people in that audience who are going to go, oh, you could do this or that. So it sort of networks itself in an interesting kind of way as well, which is good. And that's certainly the way things started. You know, we did loads of things for very little money or nothing, and just through doing them we got more things, you know. So when I talk to young people and students, I sometimes talk in unis and stuff, I always say, you know, yeah, just get out there, do stuff, make things, collaborate, make mistakes, you know, don't be afraid to feel like you've got to know what you're doing, because so many people are just blagging it, you know. So many people are just black, we're all blagging it really, aren't we? If you want to get paid and you want to have a career, I always tell this to students, like, just specialize in something and then you'll be flying straight away. You know, if you're kind of interested in loads of different things like me, and you don't want to commit yourself to one, and you kind of like this idea of sort of finding the connections, you know, this little lateralness of thinking laterally, you know, then that's a harder place to sort of survive in, I would say, even though it's a really interesting place to be, and it leads to really beautiful kind of connections. It's still difficult being a small arts-based studio. We're often doing multiple roles and multiple jobs, and taking different, you know, roles in making something. But I guess as it sort of developed, as we've sort of done larger projects and we've had more money and we've had budgets and we can bring in people specifically to do specific jobs, that does change. But I think also, I've never been someone who really believes in this kind of left, right side brain thing. This idea that, you know, you're either creative or you're kind of, you know, you're an organizer, you know, and I think a lot of women get this as well. I know for sure my partner, who worked in TV for a long time and is now an art therapist, she felt this, that there was a sort of, particularly women can be sort of, all right, you know, you're the organizer, these let the men do the kind of creative ideas thing. You know, I think for me, the two go hand in hand, this sort of analytical and logistical and planning and budgeting and scheduling and communication all go together with being creative. You need to be able to do both. That's why I call myself a creative producer sometimes, because I don't see myself as just purely a sort of organizational and a numbers sort of person. I'm coming up with ideas. I'm talking to other people. There's a porousness to a lot of those things that doesn't really sort of apply to this kind of cookie cutter way of describing what you do and who you are, you know. And I think the world likes that, you know, particularly the kind of freelance gig economy likes that, because it sort of allows big companies to sort of construct teams of people more and more remotely now, not even with any overheads or studio costs, you know, to sort of come together and form projects and spit them out. You know, it's the sort of mechanization of production, creativity. So I can see where that comes from. But I think most of the people that I've worked with who've been part of the Light Surgeons, who've contributed to the Light Surgeons, are all very multi-talented people who have interests in both moving image, music, sound, art, culture in general. And, you know, we're just sort of trying to form something together. But, you know, sometimes when you're dealing with clients and organizations and institutions, then they like those sort of terms, you know. They like to know, oh, you are the this and you are the that, and sometimes that's helpful. Sometimes it's sort of, you know, it's more like an easy way to write some credits at the end of something than it is really reflective of what everyone did. But I think, you know, I spent a long time actually diligently trying to credit everyone. So if you do go onto the website after listening to this, there's an awful lot of different links to people's work. I'm really keen on, this isn't just my work, it's a group of people who've worked on this over 25 years, and they all do incredible stuff. So I try to sort of link everyone and credit everyone on as best I can. But as I say, there's a blurring of these things, you know, they're never that cut and dry. So where I'm sitting now is over 25 years of doing this sort of work. And it is amazing to look back on all the different things we've done, because it is very diverse. There's a lot of different things. So many dreams. I mean, I just mentioned David Lynch as a reference, and I keep going back to David Lynch. I don't know, he's such an enigmatic and interesting character on so many levels. And I rewatched all the Twin Peaks return of Twin Peaks. And I really love the way his work plays with this sort of space of kind of dream kind of logic. And I think, as someone who's never made anything that's fictional, and really most of my work is really rooted in documentary and sort of this sort of expressionistic experimental documentary, I would love to go and do something that explores that space, this sort of liminal space about kind of, you know, subconscious and dreaming. And, you know, I think his work's always been huge, and I love the music that he works with and the music he makes himself as well. He actually signed to this record label, Sunday Best Records, which is actually set up by my friend Rob DeBank, which was really, the name Sunday Best is from me. I came up with it. It was a gig and a night that we did in South London. It was like one of the first sort of things we did when I came back to London from uni. So there's some connections. So I'd love to reach out to David and like meet him. I just think he's an incredible character. So that would be cool. And that's an area. And in terms of form, I don't know. I mean, I still really enjoy the live shows, this sort of space between cinema, performance, music, the kind of keeping this kind of looseness, but like a story. It's a hard thing to tour with, and it's a hard thing to keep out there, and the pandemic really was a problem and kind of killed off a big commission project from the British Film Institute for us. So it's starting to come back, but there are other kind of online platforms. I'm sort of interested in work that could engage with more audience interaction. We did some sort of experiments in one of our live shows using Twitter with the audience, where the audience is sort of interacting. So this idea that everyone has a phone in their pocket in the audience could be a really fun thing to explore more with purpose-made apps that then create something, or there's some sort of dialogue or conversation or data that the audience are implicitly involved in somehow. So I'm sort of interested in that as an idea. I recently got my driving license, which is kind of crazy to have got to my age and not had a car, growing up in the city and not really needing to have a car and getting by on public transport and getting around. I don't know how I managed it, but that freedom of driving and hitting the road has been a real kind of influence on me recently, and this sort of being stuck in the UK and not really being able to travel so much, and also being more mindful of traveling and flying and climate and whatnot, has really made me look at my country again with fresh eyes. So I really want to make something that's a bit kind of like what we did in Malaysia with this Super Everything project, this sort of kind of journey across the landscape that sort of looks at identity and ritual and place and sort of poses these sort of questions around who we are as a society. I'd really like to turn that on my country, the United Kingdom, you know, as sort of just been through this whole coronation thing, dream, hallucination, this sort of consensual hallucination of a monarchy who rule over us. I just can't quite express like how weird that is, and sort of how archaic and bizarre it is to live in a great place and in a country that's free in so many ways and lucky and, you know, tolerant in many, many ways, but still, you know, I feel there's some deep questions that we need to ask ourselves, especially since the sort of Brexit thing. So I'd really like to do something that explores my country, the place I'm from, and this sort of idea of sonification, you know, this idea of being able to turn data from one thing into sound, and being able to listen to, you know, the topology, the landscape, and to sort of go on walks, you know. I spent a lot of time walking during the pandemic with my kids and going into the forest and the woods. And so I quite like this idea of taking people on these sort of walks where we get to sort of chat, like a sort of ramble chat with some interesting kind of characters, you know, scientists, philosophers, poets, almost like a pilgrimage. You know, this idea of a pilgrimage was something that we used to do, you know, to sort of heal ourselves, you know, to go to and go to the spa and to walk to Bath and to bathe in the waters and to go back to our little villages. And, you know, I think we need to go back to some of our pre-Christian sort of neo-pagan ideas, you know, of reconnecting ourselves with each other and the landscape and who we are. I think they're the things I'd love to explore, maybe with some sort of Lynchian sort of drizzle. But who knows? So yeah, I guess people say, you know, you return to similar themes and like you're kind of remaking the same work. I think there's some sort of truth to that in some of the different projects. There's a sort of themes that we've certainly returned to. It's like the sort of the mother's milk in your, yeah, the kind of DNA, you know. I mean, as a father, I've got two small kids, they're like 7 and 9. So you see these sort of, you know, the imaginative play that they have at this age is really fascinating to me. You know, this, they haven't quite got captured by devices yet. So they're sort of in this really magical place where they're constantly creating up stories and making things at home. And it's a nightmare because my house is just totally trashed every day. But I love that idea of play. And I think for me, I have mad memories of Star Wars figures and setups and doing these sort of intricate physical sort of installation-y type things at home that I was doing, you know. And my brother was also into that, but then the computer came along and he had the ZX81 and he had the Spectrum. And then I was like the younger brother who was like constantly just looking over his shoulder while he was like on the computer. And so I don't know, there's some funny things. I think that you know, there's sort of fascinations and sort of genres and themes, I guess, that are very deep rooted in your childhood, you know, that you then continue to explore the sort of playfulness of things. I think I could look back over the work I've done and there's a sort of naivety to some of it. I think sometimes when I was in Malaysia recently and we went back 10 years later with this sort of gallery thing, you know, from where I sit now, I think some of the things, I don't know if I'd have done them the same way now, after spending a lot of time working with this anthropologist and different things. So that, you know, you're kind of, your practice and your work evolves, but maybe some of your, you know, unconscious fascinations are there from a very, very young age, you know. And I see that with my kids already. I see that they do certain things even from a really young age. My eldest daughter B, she, even when she had no toys, she'd be making these stories up where her hands would be talking to each other. and I just think there's a storyteller there that's definitely coming out. And so I'm trying to introduce them to like animation, and I've got some little apps on the iPhone that do stop frame, and we set up a little rostrum at home. And so I'm trying to get them into the idea that they can make their own stuff, you know, that they don't have to just be passive to it. I mean, I'm approaching 50, but you know, I'm still a kid, you know, I still like playing around with stuff.
For more information about Christopher Thomas Allen and the Light Surgeons, go to lightsurgeons.com. Check out the Light Surgeons Super Everything project at www.supereverything.net. And for the Super Everything vinyl release on Utter Recordings, go to the Light Surgeons Bandcamp or on all major streaming platforms. More film and documentation of the Light Surgeons installations and performance work can be found on the Light Surgeons YouTube and Vimeo channels. And follow them at The Light Surgeons on all social media. Subscribe to Pieces of Work wherever you get your podcasts, or live and direct on jasoncharles.net talk channel. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Pieces of Work on jasoncharles.net.
Work for a living.
JasonCharles.net. Deep talk, deep sounds.
Oh, wow. That's deep.
Very, very deep.